Ted disliked the attention he was attracting, fearing that Danny would discover his presence. He kept his voice low. 27. I met many people called Pierre in France. How am I to know which one this is? Ted was being difficult, trying to trip the medium who, nevertheless, continued undaunted. This Pierre is now showing me a scene, he said. You are both standing under some trees alongside your lorries. It is a battlefield, there is a bridge. Pierre is saying, you stay here, I will go over first. He leaves you to cross the bridge. As he does so, there is a great explosion. The bridge is blown up. Pierre is killed. Ted was astounded. He recalled the incident very well, and remembered his friend. He was further taken aback when the medium remarked that Ted, too, could contact the dead and bring messages of hope to the living. I suggest you join a circle and develop this gift, the medium urged. This conversation was overheard by Annie. Needless to say, she was delighted. Annie persuaded me to form our own circle, smiled Ted. After only three sittings, I was controlled by my spirit guide, Michael. That's how it happened. There was nothing I could do about it. But now I'm glad, Lou, very glad. It has changed my life. I asked him if he had seen Dad. He replied, no, I haven't seen him, but he has been described to me. Ted paused, as if listening, and continued, Michael is saying you will see Dad before I do. Lovely thought, isn't it? Somewhat shamefaced, I took my leave, begging him not to mention the subject to Alec and Mother when he came to see us. Alec is sure to object, I said. It will only cause trouble. Ted did not take umbrage at my rudeness. He merely put an arm about my shoulders, and smiled. Don't worry, 28, he promised. I will hold my tongue. But mark my words, Michael is never wrong. I did not discuss this conversation with anyone, least of all Alec. So he was quite unprepared for what happened 2 months later. Alec had to make a business call on a Mr. Hewitt, whose house was across the road from us. Finding he was not yet back from work, Alec fell into conversation with his wife, Mary. A chance remark she made, apropos of nothing they were discussing, caused Alec to beat a hasty retreat. According to Alec, Mary seemed to look through him, rather than at him, as she remarked, "You have a lot of lights around you, Mr. Harris. Do you know you are a very powerful medium?" Alec stammered. "What kind of a medium do you mean?" Mary replied, "Why, a spiritualist medium, of course." This caused Alec to take his leave with undue abruptness, much to Mrs. Hewitt's amusement. As he burst through our door, he gasped the story out breathlessly to me, ending with the observation, "Fancy a nice, sensible woman like Mrs. Hewitt being a spiritualist." However, it was this chance meeting with Mary Hewitt, herself a medium, which set our feet on spiritualism's path. They became firmly planted, never deviating for the rest of our lives. 2 weeks after this meeting, the couple invited us to spend a few days with them in their caravan. Needless to say, the conversation was mostly about spiritualism. I was fascinated by Mary Hewitt's many psychic experiences. Seeing my interest, she invited me to go with her the 29th, following Sunday to a spiritualist church. To my surprise, I found myself accepting. Alec would have no part of it. As soon as I arrived at the little church, a sense of peace and contentment descended on me. Mrs. Hewitt whispered to me, "You belong here." Somehow, I felt that I did. The simple service appealed to me. I was most impressed with the impromptu address given by one of the congregation members. It seemed to answer most of the nagging questions that had been troubling me. One facet of spirit communication which intrigued me was table moving. At our next meeting, I asked Mary if she had experienced this phenomenon. She had and suggested if I was interested, we should try it out that afternoon. I was delighted, and a little nervous, wondering what Alec would say if he found out. Mary said that the table moved with more facility if it was a light one. As hers were of the heavy variety, she asked if I could bring along one from my home. After lunch, I was creeping softly downstairs, my little table clutched under my arm, when to my dismay the door was flung open and Alec came into the hall. He stopped in his tracks, puzzled by my antics. His eyes alighted on the piece of furniture I had under my arm. "Where are you going with that?" he asked suspiciously. Overcome with confusion, I blurted out, "To Mary Hewitt. We are going to try a table a moving seance." Alec's mouth fell open. When it snapped shut, he looked angry. I thought he would explode. "That you are not," he said. Then he called, "Mother, your daughter's going to a seance. Come and tell her she's not to go. I don't want her mixed up in that sort of nonsense." 30. Mother came hurrying into the hall and saw us. Alec's face was dark with anger. I stood on the stairs, looking very determined, holding the small table. "Look, Alec," said Mother reasonably, "she's a wife and a mother. She should know what she's doing." Alec turned on his heel and left the house. I felt upset that I was going against Alec's wishes, but experienced a great urge to continue the séance. I left the house, still clutching my small table, and went to the Hewitts' home. Mr. Hewitt opened the door. He smiled in amusement when he saw the table, but made no comment. He was a tolerant man and, though not interested in spiritualism, did not interfere with his wife's participation. I was taken to Mary's bedroom, where the séance was to be held. "We will sit for only an hour," said Mary. "If nothing happens, we'll try another time." We waited. Nothing happened. I experienced a feeling of acute disappointment. Eventually, Mary decided to close the séance. At this juncture, there was a knock on the bedroom door. Mr. Hewitt entered, ushering in a strange man who, it appeared, had just called at the house to see him on business. On hearing the singing from upstairs, he asked about it, and was informed that a séance was in progress. The visitor was most interested, saying he, too, was a spiritualist. Would Mr. Hewitt, he wondered, permit him to assist us? With a smile, Mary's husband agreed, and led him upstairs to where our unsuccessful séance was about to close. Introducing him, Mr. Hewitt explained, "This gentleman is a spiritualist. He has been directed to help you. May he join you?" 31. "Yes," said Mary. "Come in. Sit down and place your hands with ours on the table." He did so. To my astonishment, in a very short while the table moved. It rose slowly and lifted itself into my lap. As we recited the alphabet, it would rock, coming to an abrupt halt when the required letter was called. This way it spelled out the name Tom. Mrs. Hewitt asked, "To whom do you wish to speak?" The table replied, "Lou. That's my name." I cried excitedly. "My father's name is Tom." "That's interesting," commented Mary. "Ask him any questions you wish to confirm his identity." This I did. All were answered correctly by my father. There now seemed to be a lot of power available. The table had no difficulty in moving. Our hands were barely touching its surface. The strange gentleman withdrew his entirely and sat back with his hands on his knees. Yet still the table continued to move. I asked my father what his second name was. The answer came, "John." I was disappointed as I thought this was incorrect. It should have been Richard. However, I consoled myself with the fact that all the other information had been accurate. We then closed at Mary's suggestion. The stranger took his departure downstairs. I told Mary I felt quite sure that I had found my beloved dad. As I said this, there came three loud knocks on the wardrobe, which was some distance from us. Mary said, "That is your dad saying yes." She added, "I feel strong physical mediumship emanating from you. There is great work ahead for you to do." When I recounted my experience to Mother, commenting on the only error being Dad's second name, she said, "32, that was no mistake. Your father's other name was John. Richard is your brother's second name." I was greatly relieved. Alec was furious when I told of the knocks. "You'll end up in an asylum," he snorted. "You are just fooling yourself with your own thoughts. I'm coming over next Sunday to prove to you it is all a lot of nonsense." I was filled with misgiving. Fortunately, he did not carry out his threat. Later, I accused him of not having the courage of his convictions because he had not turned up to justify his words of condemnation. I flounced off to bed without telling him what had transpired at our second sitting, again a very successful one. The table was active, without the stranger's assistance. Alec remained downstairs, obviously deep in thought. Round midnight, he came upstairs and woke me. "I will not let you go to sleep until you sit with me," he said. "We'll soon see that this whole thing is ridiculous nonsense." I was afraid to sit without Mrs. Hewitt for fear that nothing would happen. I would never live it down. I protested, "Not now, Alec, it's midnight. Tomorrow perhaps?" "You are afraid," he taunted. "You know I can prove that it doesn't really happen. It's all in the mind." Alec pointed at my forehead. Incensed, I retorted, "You are the one who should be afraid, ridiculing something like this when it's true." We found a suitable small table in the bedroom and commenced. Fortunately, no light came into the room from outside. It was a new area with a few houses. The street, 33, lighting had not yet been completed. Only a faint glow came from the gas fire. I told Alec Mrs. Hewitt was emphatic that no circle should begin without a prayer, and explained we would sit for only 1 hour. Time passed. Nothing happened. There were no manifestations, no movement of the table occurred. It appeared resolutely glued to the floor. Alec became restless, and at the same time was a trifle smug that he had made his point. My disappointment became an unbearable longing. I silently prayed, "Oh, God. Please let something happen to convince Alec." Immediately, I had a feeling of being lifted up. The whole room was illuminated by an unearthly blue light. It swelled gradually in luminosity, as though someone had turned up a gas mantle. Then, just as gradually, it diminished in brilliance. I was afraid, so was Alec. He said, "Heavens! What's that?" "I don't know," I whispered. With that, the table began to rock violently. "You are moving it," accused Alec. I removed one hand from the table, still holding the other lightly over it. When it continued to move, Alec insisted I was manipulating it with my legs. I was indignant and moved away, sitting right back from the table. Still it continued to rock. I asked nervously, "Is that you, Dad?" The entity acquiesced, and gave a message. Alec was not impressed. He maintained he was already aware of the information proffered, having been told the same thing by me some time before. "Well, ask it something yourself," I suggested. Hesitantly, Alec asked if there was anybody there who wished to speak to him. Instantly, the table's movements ceased to be so, 34, violent and gently spelled out Con, the name of Alec's beloved sister. Tragically, she had contracted tuberculosis, passing on November 27, 1923. Connie returned that evening, obviously aware that if anything could convince her brother of life after death, it would be her spirit communication. But Alec did not accept it. Her message was too similar to one I had often spoken of before. Alec attributed the communication to the manifestation of my thought, not hers. The question of how the table moved seemed to escape him. I reminded Alec there must have been hundreds of incidents which had taken place between himself and Connie about which I knew nothing. I suggested that if he were to ask her about any one of these, and receive a satisfactory answer, perhaps then he would accept that his sister was, indeed, present. Tentatively he asked, "Con, do you remember, the week before you died, I read a book to you, and you expressed a wish that I should finish it and tell you how it ended?" "Yes," came the gentle reply. "Can you give me the name of that book?" Alec probed. Immediately the answer came back, "Girl of the Limber Lost." Alec was shaken. "But that's amazing," he said. "Only I could possibly know that." "The," I said. "You must believe now that your sister is here." I quickly asked her a question, hoping for further proof of her spirit presence. "Can you see us?" I queried. She replied she could. "And the baby?" I added. She affirmed this, too. "Where has he got his hands?" Without any hesitation she spelled out, "On his head." I had my back to the cot so Alec asked me to have a look. I got up and peeped at the baby. 35, sure enough, as he lay peacefully asleep, his hands were on his head. What could be more convincing? Alec was silent, unable to speak, so great was his amazement. Up to that point he had firmly believed that all spirit communication was a well-handled hoax. Contact with his dead sister moved him greatly. Her loss had been a bitter blow from which he had not yet recovered. Naturally, we sat every night after that and received some truly remarkable messages. At times these were marred by nonsensical trivialities. Later we learned these were possibly the result of interference by mischievous entities who used the table as it was the easiest form of communication. We found table moving an extremely slow way of communication, so decided to improve on it. We cut out the letters of the alphabet and arranged them in a circle, placing a glass or tumbler in the center with our hands lightly over it. We found it would move quickly from letter to letter and spell out spirit messages. This was a much more satisfactory method. We abandoned the table. Things were going well when, quite suddenly, all messages ceased, and only one kept repeating itself, "Join hands." Being novices, we could not understand its meaning. I asked Mary Hewitt what she thought it meant. "They want you to sit in a circle and join hands to build up the power," said Mary. "Obviously one of you is a trance medium. I think it is Alec." I told Alec, but we did not do anything about it at that stage. Some time later, when I went to church with Mary one Sunday, I saw she was ill. After the service she walked on ahead slowly. I stayed to get a book from the church library. 36. When I joined her she remarked, "Marie Threes, her spirit guide, has been here. She says Alec can give me healing. I will come over this afternoon, if I may, and we will try it." She urged me not to mention the ailment's location as it would provide further proof of Alec's mediumship if he found it himself. At 3 p.m. sharp Mary arrived. The three of us, she, Alec and I, went into the lounge and sat with our hands linked. After a short while, Mary said quietly, "Now, Alec, give me some healing, please." Alec was embarrassed and stammered, "But I don't know how, or what to do." "Just pass your hands lightly over my body," Mary said. "You will be spirit impressed what to do." Alec looked self-conscious as he tried to follow Mary's advice. Quite suddenly, I sensed a spirit presence and then had my first clairvoyant vision. I saw a small Chinese boy overshadowing Alec. His hands moved very quickly, as they passed over the exact spot on Mary's body where the pain was located. Afterwards, Alec confessed to feeling very strange during the healing session. He felt he could not control his arms. It was as if some other force was manipulating them. Mary attributed this to the little Chinese boy who she, too, saw with Alec. We were all very excited, feeling that we were making fast progress. The following Sunday, Mary asked if she could bring her sister, Artie, for healing. She had been ill with a nasty dose of flu. It left her with a persistent catarrh and sinus condition. The pair arrived at our house, but Alec was not keen on treating outsiders. He refused to heal Artie. Mary tried to give her sister healing. No sooner had she, 37, commenced than Alec was controlled and went into trance. He administered to Artie, who immediately felt a marked benefit. The session completed, Alec sat down and started to sing a little Chinese song. I knew then that the controlling entity was the little Chinese boy I had seen at the previous circle. He told us his name was Toy Toy, and subsequently, attached himself to our circle. I was still employed as a violinist at the theater and did not get home until 10:30 p.m. This meant we could have a proper circle only on Sunday evenings. As we were anxious to know more about this wonderful revelation, we sat most nights in meditation to help prepare the way for spirit friends to manifest. During one of our meditation sessions I looked up and, to my great astonishment, saw an elderly Chinese standing beside Alec. He appeared to be a physical being, certainly not merely a vision. He wore a beautifully embroidered Chinese robe. A small, round, black hat was perched on his head. His pale yellow skin was drawn tightly across high cheekbones, eyes aslant. The form stood scrutinizing me, his gaze penetrating, searching. So real did he seem that I was frightened. The figure must have realized his sudden appearance made me afraid, for he disappeared as suddenly as he came. I could not get the strange visitor out of my mind, nor he us, apparently. A few weeks later, as I sat quietly beside Alec while he slept on the divan, I glanced at his face and noticed with bewilderment that his features were changing. As I watched, he slowly acquired a Mongolian appearance, with the unmistakable high cheekbones. Alex's eyes narrowed, becoming upturned at the outer corners. His mouth was drawn, 38, slightly downwards. Alex being overshadowed by a Chinese, I gasped. I was dismayed, not knowing quite what to do. Then from Alec came a voice. It was Oriental in inflection, high-pitched and nasal. "Little lady," it said. "Chang come to help, not to harm you." The calm words reassured me. I moved across to the divan and had a closer look at the face. At once I recognized the elderly Chinese I saw previously. Alec's lips parted slowly. The voice intoned again, "You must make a time when I can come to speak with you. It is very important, and concerns the development of the medium. There is great work to be done. Chang will look after medium always. I am his principal guide. I will always be on hand to help him." With these comforting words, Chang quietly withdrew from Alec. His features returned to normal as he slept. I felt a great flood of relief that matters were now under the control of a trustworthy guide. Many had controlled Alec, but somehow they did not belong. Chang did. We acquired a valuable, lifelong friend in Alec's chief guide. We sat most nights in meditation, sending out healing, giving the guides an opportunity to develop Alec's mediumship. Little Toy Toy was a frequent visitor, bringing a lot of power to our circle. One evening a young man communicated. He had been one of the first to use the glass and alphabet. The spirit visitor said his name was Joachim, a young Russian of about 25. He had died on horseback while trying to escape from the enemy in the First World War. Each time he came, Joachim reenacted the circumstances which caused his death. This was traumatic, to say the least. Alec had to suffer 39 boisterous and even rough treatment from him. Joachim was generally difficult and appeared to resent having been sent to work with us. Often he was quite disagreeable, complaining that our rooms were always too hot. He brought freezing cold winds which caused us to shiver in discomfort. I was far from happy about this state of affairs. I feared for Alec, who, when controlled by Joachim, was completely at his mercy. We were greatly relieved when this young Russian was removed from our circle for 6 months. When he returned, he was made to treat Alec's body with much more care. Despite this rough patch in their association, both Alec and Joachim were told, first through famed medium Helen Hughes, later through others, that they would become closer than brothers, and would walk arm in arm. How true this proved to be. Joachim eventually became one of our band of trusted guides. What a wonderful friend that lad has been to me and to hundreds over the years. Shortly after Joachim returned to our circle, Alec and I sat in the lounge chatting, when my husband suddenly announced he could hear a foreign language and had an urge to speak it. "Speak then," I said. "Just do what you are impressed to do." Alec emitted a flow of quite incomprehensible words, which obviously had the pattern and grouping of intelligent speech. After a moment, the spirit entity present seemed to realize I was completely at a loss to understand what he was saying. He promptly changed to English, projecting a beautiful, deep, rich and resonant voice. "My name is Iwanga," he said. "I come to tell you I am, 40, the medium's bodyguard. From henceforth, no one will control him without my sanction." I felt very relieved, realizing that at last our circle was being properly managed and controlled from the other side. I expressed my gratitude to this gentle yet authoritative spirit. What a source of strength he proved to be over the years. I came to love this Red Indian dearly. We both trusted him implicitly. Iwanga was always present at our seances, guiding Alec while entranced. We had long, interesting talks with him about spiritual matters. During one of these he told me that a spirit entity who was greatly loved and respected, even revered, was being sent to take charge of our circle. "Louis One," he said, this was the name he always called me, "this advanced spirit being belongs to you. Many sit at his feet and listen. He speaks words of wisdom. Already they are preparing the path by which he will come to you. Be prepared to receive him. Though Iwanga did not give us the name of this spirit entity who had attached himself to me, we were impatient to make his acquaintance. But patience was something we had to learn to cultivate while Alec was developing his mediumship. Things do not usually happen quickly in this field. After Iwanga's manifestation, our circle was much better organized. We always followed any advice he gave. He told us to form a circle of regular sitters, and always to hold our seance on a Sunday night. The guide stressed the importance of these two factors if we wished to make progress. At one of these Sunday night sittings, a deep baritone 41 voice announced himself as Adula, then struck his breast, and repeated, "Adula come." He was an African, and had a poor command of English. This improved greatly over the long years of his association with us, but Adula never became fluent in the language. Adula was a wonderful soul and became very closely associated with Alec as his healing guide. And what a remarkable healer he was, with numerous cures to his credit. No. I correct that. Adula never took credit for any of the miraculous healings which occurred while Alec was controlled by him. When many blessed his name and thanked him, he would spurn such thanks, saying with deep humility, "No thank Adula. God give Adula. And Adula just give you." It was his way of saying that all healing came from God, that he was just a channel directing healing to wherever it was needed. At the healing sessions, Adula always worked with an ordinary pocket handkerchief. Using it like an X-ray, he would hold up the unfolded handkerchief and view the patient's body through it, moving it about until he found where the organs, bones or ligaments were out of balance. There was never any need to describe ailments to him or even indicate their situations. With uncanny infallibility, Adula located the complaint. Never, at any time, did he presume to diagnose. He knew what was wrong and where. Without comment or discussion with the patient, he would proceed to administer spirit healing. Placing the handkerchief over the affected part, Adula blew onto it a stream of healing breath. Sometimes he emitted a deep-throated humming sound, low-key and vibrant, which generated power. In turn, this produced 42 heat. More often than riot, the patient felt relief almost immediately. Some spectacular cures took place instantaneously, others required a series of treatments, possibly over a long period. On Iwanga's advice, we formed a healing circle. Adula was always present to administer to the sick through Alec. He was happiest working in this field of mediumship. 43-44, Chapter 4. Her dead daughter returns. Though I was very pleased with the way Alec's trance mediumship developed, and was happy to meet the guides who, one by one, attached themselves to our circle, I often thought of my brother's prophecy that I would see my dead father before he did. I wondered when and how this could possibly happen. Needless to say, it came about, and in rather unusual circumstances. Though I did not know it, I was about to be introduced to a most astounding type of mediumship, materialization. One not only heard, saw, touched and embraced lost loved ones, but they appeared as solid and real as any physical being. In appearance, they were no different from when they were on Earth. My mother had a niece named Maggie, but because she was so much older than I always called her Aunt Maggie. She was a very religious woman, attending every Pentecostal church service or prayer meeting whenever possible. The rest of the time she devoted to her large family. The four girls and three boys lived happily together, though a trifle cramped, in a small house in Porth. Of necessity, the three younger girls Ethel, Doris and Jeanette, slept together in one bedroom. Quite suddenly, Ethel, an extremely beautiful girl, with long, golden hair reaching to below her waist, fell ill with, 45, tuberculosis. She quickly succumbed and passed. Because of their cramped sleeping conditions, her sisters contracted the deadly disease and died within 18 months of Ethel. Poor Aunt Maggie was desolate with grief, overcome by this appalling tragedy which struck her close-knit family. Only her unswerving faith in God kept her sane. Despite her triple bereavement, she had no desire to communicate with her beloved daughters, thinking spiritualism was the work of the devil. Aunt Maggie firmly believed they would lie peacefully asleep in their graves awaiting the call of the last trumpet. My brother, Ted, used to visit her weekly in an effort to bring a measure of comfort. Naturally, he tentatively put out feelers to see what her attitude was regarding life after death. Ted suggested that he might help her to communicate with Ethel, Doris and Jeanette. Aunt Maggie was aghast.